Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 46.
Flight 209, you are clear for takeoff.
Roger.
LA departing 123.9.
Roger.
Hello and welcome to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, the view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 808 at the Sheraton Hotel in beautiful downtown Oklahoma City. On today's show, my favorite airplanes, those crazy Russians, the bombardment method, and more. So, get all settled in, tray tables and seat backs in their upright and locked positions, electronic devices powered on. Flight 46 is ready for pushback. Hello again, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Airline Pilot Guy Show. I'm Captain Jeff in Oklahoma City, as I mentioned at the beginning here. Day two of a three-day trip. Let's see, yesterday we were... Well, first of all, let me tell you about coming into Oklahoma City today. Quite a windy day. It's often that way this time of year in Oklahoma. And First Officer Greg did a wonderful job managing the landing with the winds gusting into the mid-30s, probably close to 40 miles per hour, some gusts there. But fortunately, it was mostly down the runway. So he had quite a handful there, but did a great job. Yesterday in Des Moines, Iowa, that was day one of our three-day trip. This is day two. And I just thought of something as I was preparing for the show. I thought I remember somebody sending me feedback that said that they lived either in Des Moines or not too far from Des Moines. And next time I was there, I was to call them and let them know. Sorry, whoever that was. I did a quick search on my Gmail to see who that was, but I could not. I couldn't find the email, so I'm sorry. Not that it matters, because I didn't think of it until now, and I'm in Oklahoma City. I mean, a lot of good that does, right? Oh, well, I apologize. So if you're listening out there and you live near the Des Moines area, next time, send me another email. Next time, I'll try to remember to give you a call, and we can meet for some beers. First Officer Greg and I went over to a place called the Raccoon River Brewing Company and had a beer and some dinner, and it was pretty good. I think the first time that I laid over in Des Moines ended up going to the Court Avenue Brewing Company. And from what I remember, I'm not sure if the beers were any better, but I thought the food was better. But I don't know.
Captain, incoming message.
Thank you. All right. This from John in Minneapolis. He said, "Greetings, Captain Jeff. I just finished listening to Airline Pilot Guy episode 45 while on an Acme flight from Minneapolis to Philadelphia. Another excellent podcast, by the way. Thanks. Unfortunately, my flight was on an Acme Express CRJ-900 aircraft, which was somewhat cramped due to the small aircraft size. Oh well, I guess it balances out the Acme flight I had last week from Atlanta to New Orleans, which was on a huge Boeing 767-300 for no apparent reason. The economy cabin was only half full with 143 seats still occupied, or still unoccupied, that is. My recent flights brought to mind a couple of questions and a comment. First question, what criteria do airlines use when selecting an aircraft type for a particular flight or route? Obviously, the distance of the flight will be a large factor in this. You don't want to make a transatlantic flight with a CRJ-900. But what about domestic North American flights of average length, the 2 to 4 hour range? I'm still puzzled by the choice of a Boeing 767-300 for a short 90-minute flight from Atlanta to New Orleans, which had no ongoing stops beyond New Orleans and clearly didn't have the volume of passengers to justify such a large aircraft. As far as I could tell, the aircraft was just going to be parked at New Orleans overnight and then fly back to Atlanta in the morning. I realize that the flight crew doesn't have a choice of which aircraft is used for a particular route, But perhaps one of your coworkers in ACME's dispatch or flight operations departments might know the answer. Okay, I'll stop right there and try to attempt an answer at that question. Good. It's a really good question, and it's a question that a lot of times we, the flight crews, ask as well. And there's a lot of stuff, a lot of information that we don't have access to as pilots and flight attendants, like all the numbers, all the yields that we get from the various tickets sold and, you know, average cost of the ticket or, you know, average margin that we're getting from each ticket, et cetera. So a lot of it has to do with that. A lot of it also has to do with several things here. The time of year. We're kind of in a lull right now. I've been flying the last couple, well, I fly every week. But the last couple of weeks, I've really noticed quite a large drop-off on most of the flights I'm flying. And unless you're talking about a hub-to-hub flight, and they're always packed. But going to places like New Orleans or Des Moines or Kansas City, although Kansas City always seems to be pretty full as well. But anyway, a lot of the flights are not as full as they have been in the past. And again, I think it's that time of year. It's going to start ramping up again as we get closer to Thanksgiving. And then, of course, the Thanksgiving to Christmas time is always a very, very busy time of year for us. But sometimes another thing to consider is the flight going from Atlanta to New Orleans may not be full, but that flight the next morning that was, you know, that 767-300 was making up to come back to Atlanta, most likely was full to the brim because a lot of people are going to the hubs to connect to a different destination. So that could be a possibility as well. The way this whole thing works is that, you know, each airline has its own departments. And I believe at ACME it's the marketing department. Jan, if you're listening, she works in one of the departments of the company that deal with, I'm not sure, Jan. Is it yield management or is it special route? I forgot exactly what you're doing now. But there is a department in marketing that kind of looks at demand and tries to pick the most appropriate airplane for a particular route segment. And I think that changes from the time of year. Things to consider is how much the flight crew is getting paid. The pilots on a larger airplane get more money per hour than pilots on a smaller airplane, so that's factored in. Several things are factored in, actually. But so that, if Jan, if you're listening, maybe you could provide some feedback regarding that. I don't know. Sometimes it's really kind of puzzling for us too, John. In fact, I've even seen situations where, for instance, here I'm in Oklahoma City. We used to fly, I think, 8 or 9 round trips from Oklahoma City to Dallas-Fort Worth, like 9 going and 9 coming back, something like that. And every single one of them was full or oversold. And the company decided that they pull the service out of there because they couldn't compete. Now, to most people, including myself and fellow pilots, we'd say, what? Why not? I mean, if it's full and you can't compete in that market, well, then just raise the cost of the ticket. And apparently, flying, especially in that market segment, is a commodity. And people are willing to pay a certain amount. But once it goes over a certain amount, they decide, well, no, I'll just drive. It's cheaper that way. And so even making a small incremental change in the price of a ticket, let's say, you know, $5, $10 per ticket, could mean the difference between people either not flying or going to the competition. And so it was ACME's, this is the information I got from somebody, it was their assessment and the yield management department that airplane or those airplanes used on those flights from that city segment, Oklahoma City, Dallas-Fort Worth, would be better utilized in a market where they have higher yields. So if they're going to be paying for the airplane, paying for the flight crews and all the support costs that are involved with operating in and out of airports, They decided that they'd be able to make more money by using it somewhere else. Again, it's one of those head scratchers for us, too. That's the best I can do with that answer. In other words, I don't know. I'm puzzled myself, John. Okay, his second question. How often do the captain or first officer do a visual walk-around inspection of the exterior of the aircraft prior to boarding the passengers? I haven't noticed any flight deck personnel walking around the outside of any aircraft at any of the airports I've been at in the past year. But maybe I just wasn't paying enough attention. Is this something that you routinely do in the morning when you first get your aircraft assignment? Okay, the answer is every single flight we do a walk around. It's required. In fact, when we get into the cockpit and before we push back from the gate, we have a checklist called the pre-flight checklist. And the pre-flight checklist, the first item is exterior and interior pre-flight. And then I respond, checked. And so that includes all the cockpit pre-flight items that are required. If it's the first flight of the day, there are some extra things that we check, and it's only once per day that we check these things. But every flight, there are a lot of things that are required to be checked, like the fire warning systems, the cargo fire warning system, etc. The exterior pre-flight is something that we do for every flight. I mean, you wouldn't want to take an airplane somewhere with a panel hanging off or big puddles of hydraulic fluid or oil on the ramp. And, you could have known that there was something wrong with the airplane, called maintenance and have them take a look at it. So, excuse me. Yes, we do pre-flights, exterior pre-flights, every single flight. Now, at ACME, and I suspect a lot of airlines, it is the official job of the first officer every flight to go and do a walk around. Now, a lot of us at ACME and other airlines, we captains, will kind of say, hey, if it's not my leg, if it's my first officer's leg, I'll do the walk around outside. It's nice to get some fresh air, number one. And number two, it's good to kind of keep the finger in the pudding or whatever the saying is, to kind of, just keep abreast of what you're looking for on the outside of the airplane. Because every year or so when we go to recurrent training, we look at slides, and it's kind of nice to know, what you're looking at when you go to training every year. Now, there are some exceptions, and everybody has their personal minimums. I mean, if it's, below freezing or it's raining / snowing or something other, like hazardous something going out, uncomfortable, then chances are I might go ahead and defer that walk around, the honor of the walk around, to my first officer. So, but most of the time, even when the weather is a little bit bad, I will offer to do a walk around when it is my first officer's leg. And remember, we normally alternate other legs or every other leg, or sometimes if we're going in and out of a hub city like Atlanta, we'll do pairs, like, okay, I'm going to fly from Atlanta to Des Moines and Des Moines to Atlanta. You can fly the Oklahoma City and back pairing, etc. And that way, the same person, the first officer, isn't always flying in and out of or into Atlanta, just to give some variety. Was that all I was going to say about exterior pre-flights? Yeah, so we do that every time. Okay, now he has a comment. Your link to the YouTube video of the ACME MD-88 flight from Atlanta to Gulfport reminded me of a commercial DVD that I watched at a friend's house several months ago. The DVD was from a company called World Air Routes, which produces in-the-cockpit videos of all sorts of different commercial aircraft. The video I watched was an Air Canada flight from Toronto to Tokyo Narita on a very large and very modern Boeing 777-300ER. The captain did an excellent job of describing all of the flight controls, computer systems, communication systems. They have a short teaser YouTube video of this particular DVD on their YouTube channel, a channel called Just Planes. The link to the Air Canada Boeing 777-300ER video is here, and I'll put that in the show notes. They seem to make these videos all over the world. Another fascinating teaser video on their YouTube channel is a Silkway Airlines Aleutian IL-76 Russian cargo plane taking off from Baku, Azerbaijan. And there's another link here. I'll have that one in the show notes as well. That's certainly one Spartan-looking airport ramp, and the glass nose feature of that aircraft is definitely unusual. As always, I look forward to your podcast. Keep me entertained and informed during my frequent Acme flights. Keep up the excellent work. Wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds, John in Minneapolis. Thanks. The same to you as well, John. Again, thanks for the links to the videos. I watched the teaser video of the 777, and I thought it was a very nice job as well. I kind of wish we could do those at Acme, but I don't think that is something that has been tried or accomplished or whatever. I noticed that a lot of those videos were from Air Canada, so there must be some kind of a special agreement with that company to do these videos. Maybe Air Canada is getting some money for them or something. I don't know. Yeah, so it was nice. Oh, one of the cool things about that video is that I don't think we have them on the Acme 777s, but they have a tail mounted, a couple cameras mounted on the tail, one on the pointing forward, looking at the trailing edge of the wing and the pod mounted engines on either side. You know, one on the left side, one on the right side, and so when you're taxiing around, you can see exactly where the main landing gear trucks are. And it also, there's another one that shows the view behind the nose wheel and looking forward. And then in flight, it was kind of cool. There was another scene where you could see the contrails coming out of the, the jet exhaust coming out and spinning contrails. I thought that was pretty cool. So check it out. Thanks again, John. Oh, I hope that wasn't too loud. Okay, another piece of feedback, this time from Hillel. Hi, Captain Jeff. Hope you're having a great week. I am. Thanks. And let's see. He wanted to tell me share a fun story with me. A friend is also a private pilot and flies a plane very similar to mine. He's got about 10 times the hours I have and is also about 10 years older than me. I had just landed after a not-in-the-least uneventful two-plane stop, 760-plus nautical mile flight, with an out-of-practice pilot as a passenger. Given my experience on the flight, my friend and I were swapping stories about emergency situations and cockpit resource management in general. Not that pilots need any excuse to talk about piloting. That's true. This is an aside here. You know what pilots do when they're flying? They talk about women. And when they're with women, what do they talk about? Flying. Corny joke, I know. Okay, back to Hillel's email. He was recounting a situation in which he lost all electrical power at night while in IMC with his wife and at least one child in the plane. Yikes! The CRM situation was such that he and his wife got into a husband-wife type of discussion about whether or not to land. She insisting that they land immediately, and he asserting that continuing was the better choice. It took him a moment to realize and to point out that of the people in the plane, he was the only one that actually knew how to fly a plane, knew enough about the plane to know the actual risks and what their options were, and had the requisite experience to make a decision. From that point forward, whenever he gets in a plane, especially with his family, he asks, "Who's the captain?" and waits for his family members to respond, "You're the captain." I'm going to start using that immediately. That's a Hillel talking there. Though I honestly don't think it will stop my 10-year-old from asking me random questions about grammar or book characters in the middle of a rotation. Be clear and unlimited. Thanks, Hillel. That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that. And yes, it's always important that you have an open discussion with your fellow crew members / passengers, but you always have to remember who's in charge. And who is that? Who's the captain? You're the captain.
I've got to concentrate. Concentrate. I've got to concentrate. Concentrate. Hello?
Hello? Hello? Echo, echo, echo. Pinch hitting for Pedro Borbón. Manny Mota.
I've got to concentrate. I've got to concentrate. Apparently, I wasn't concentrating very well when I was talking or answering the question from Andy Knight on the last episode, or maybe it was a couple episodes ago. He, remember, asked me about Anchorage, and because he'd heard me say that I flew into Anchorage. Well, apparently, my almost 54-year-old brain is starting to get a little faulty, and I, in my mind, was thinking that the Anchorage Airport and Elmendorf were one of those joint-use type of facilities like Honolulu International. Hickam Air Force Base and Honolulu International kind of share the same runways and taxiways and that kind of thing. Well, Elmendorf and Anchorage are not the same airports, and that's why when I responded to his question, I said, well, I didn't think it was a big deal at all, and I never ever encountered any problem with the Lake Hood Strip and Stevens International and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, I was reminded by a couple people, and let's see, I can't remember who, but at least two of you took me to task on that. And one even included a link to a Google Map site that showed the aerial view, and now I remember. Now my memory has been jogged, and I didn't really have any footing at all to answer that question from you, Adam, or Andy, I'm sorry. So perhaps somebody else who flies in and out of Anchorage could answer the question about you know, how they feel about sharing the airspace with the folks going into that Lake Hood airport or strip. What do they call that? Land or lake runway, I guess. Yeah, it's right in the middle of Stevens International, or right next to it. That must be hair-raising for sure. So, yeah. So that's my correction, my error correction for today's episode. And I'm sure I'll make some mistakes on this one as well. So keep listening. And if you hear something that I say or have said in the past that weren't or wasn't quite right, please send in some feedback to correct me, because I want to make sure I get all the correct information out to everybody out there. This from my friend David McLeese. He sent this link from his iPhone. Apparently, nearly 1,000 people had, according to a report in the Bild newspaper, gathered for the arrival of a decommissioned by the Army transport aircraft of the type C-160 Transall. They were at the airport. Apparently, this was heading to the museum, air museum there at the airport or nearby. And let's see, to give you an idea of what this airplane looks like, it looks like a little miniature C-130. Instead of having four engines, it has two turboprop engines, high wing, T-tail type of airplane, but smaller than the C-130. And the video shows it coming in for landing. Looks a little low, and sure enough, this thing touches down on a perpendicular road just prior to the end of the runway, and very close to a lot of onlookers. And it kind of bounces up a little bit, and then it comes back down on the actual runway of the airport. Looks like a close call. I think David McLeese said, was that a, what did he say? Let's see. Well, I didn't write it down, but something like, was this a good save, or did he do this on purpose? I have no idea. Looks like a good save to me. So thanks for showing me that link. Again, we'll put that in the show notes for you to take a gander. Hi, Captain Jeff. Greetings from Mumbai, India. Big fan of the show. Your thoughts and views on the latest aviation happenings are always incredibly insightful. I myself am a newbie pilot who will soon be joining a leading Indian domestic carrier in the coming months. My first stint as a commercial airline pilot. Congratulations, Vivek. I have a lot of free time on my hands right now, and your podcast is just one of the ways to keep myself involved and up-to-date with aviation. I have a question which I've asked a lot of my instructors and seniors over the years, and I want to ask you this one too. Have you ever had an engine failure in flight? If yes, how did you handle it? If you had had multiple, what was it like the first time it happened? Were you afraid, terrified, calm, panicky, etc.? I realize that in my hopefully long and flourishing career, I might just experience some such dire emergency. I hope never to, but who knows what's around the corner. As much training is given in the simulator, an emergency in the cockpit in flight is never quite the same thing. In the simulator, if things go wrong, you can just press the pause button and try again. Unfortunately, this button doesn't exist in the real deal. I think I must have heard almost all of your podcasts to date, but I don't believe you have spoken of your bad experiences in flight. Sorry to be a negative Nancy, but I would love to hear of your worst emergencies in flight and how you managed to get it all under control. Was it all managed by the book and how CRM teaches it should be done, or did you have to bend the rules? It would be great learning for me to hear of your experiences. Anyway, I'm currently listening to Airline Pilot Guy episode number 45, and I'm already eagerly awaiting 46. Wishing you clear skies and happy landings, Vivek. And he said, P.S. would love to pick your brains over some beers if you're ever in India. Now, I think you mean you would like to ask me questions and not actually pick my brains, but I don't know. No, just kidding. Okay, your first question. First of all, thanks for your feedback, and again, congratulations on landing a job with a domestic commercial carrier in India. I hear a lot of them are having trouble, so I hope you got on with one of the ones that is doing better than some of the others. You asked if I've ever had an engine failure in flight, and yes, I have, and thankfully, well, except one. I think I had one in the L-1011. Yeah, I had one experience in the L-1011 at Acme, and that was not a big deal. We were in climb out, and it was a domestic flight, and the L-1011 was designed to be a an international kind of an airplane. So when you're flying from Tampa, Florida to Atlanta, you have a lot of performance, even with only two engines operating. And that's the only one that I've had at Acme, knock on wood. With the military experience I had, though, I think one time was a straight-out failure. You know, there are four engines on the C-141 Starlifter, and so we just had a single engine fail, and we had three remaining. I believe that was from we were en route to Honolulu, Hawaii. And we continued on, and it was no problem. It wasn't like everybody was panicky or afraid or upset about it. We just kind of accomplished it by the book. The second one was on a presidential support mission somewhere over the Nevada desert, I think. And it was an oil pressure indication that was showing low oil pressure. And so our procedures required us to shut down the engine to prevent a spontaneous shutdown and damage to that engine. Let's see. In the T-37, the trainer that I was an instructor on, in the middle of a spin, that was an interesting one, during the spin recovery, we noticed that one of the engines had failed. That's a twin-engine airplane. And the student kind of panicked a little bit, and I said, okay, wait, don't worry about the engine. Let's, recover from the spin first. And so he did a spin recovery maneuver. And then as we were recovering from the dive, I started to reach down to start motoring the engine and get it restarted. And then I noticed, oh, that engine is not rotating at all. You know, normally when you have some airflow through the engine, it's just flamed out. You'll see some kind of an indication of the compressor rotating, and in this case, no rotation. So that meant there was something kind of wrong, you know, critically wrong with that engine. So we left it alone and came back with one engine. And it was a hot summer day in Columbus, Mississippi. And if you've ever flown the T-37, you know it's not the most overpowered airplane. It's quite underpowered, actually. And we had enough energy to, you know, keep it airborne and not... it was just, let me put it this way, it was very difficult to maintain level flight on that hot day in Columbus, Mississippi, especially at pattern altitude. So we just kind of kept coming around, did our single engine overhead pattern and landed and gave it to maintenance. Probably my most hair-raising situation, which I'll elaborate on maybe on a future episode, was one in which I was, again, an instructor on the T-37. Perhaps I've talked about this before on the podcast. I don't recall if I have or not, but it was a formation flight, and so the other airplane on our wing was also a had an instructor and a student in it, and so they were on our wing, and we were recovering from the area, descending through some clouds, so we were instrument meteorological conditions, IMC, and it got pretty thick, and about the same time that we got cockpit warnings, smoke in the cockpit, the wingmen, the other airplane lost sight of us, they went lost wingmen, and we were trying to analyze what kind of situation we had in our own airplane at the time. And immediately we selected 100% oxygen on our oxygen masks, which we're always wearing in that airplane, you know, with the helmet and the parachute and the whole thing. And started analyzing why we were getting overheat warnings on both engines, cockpit unlocked warning light, and a whole host of other warning systems going off at the same time with the smoke in the cockpit. At the same time, immediately I reached down and selected 7700 on the transponder, which is the indication to air traffic control that you were experiencing an emergency. And they came back immediately with so-and-so flight. I see you're declaring an emergency. And then my wingman, the instructor in that airplane, chimed in and said, yes, we're lost wingman. And so I said, so we got, you know, separation, air traffic control separated us. And then I said, no. Well, that may be true, but we also have something going on in our airplane, and we are the ones declaring an emergency. And I was very, very close to, I guess I'm going to go ahead and just talk about it because I've pretty much described everything so far. We continued descending, and I was like within just a few seconds of commanding a bailout, in other words, ejection out of the airplane, when we exited the bottom of the cloud layer. And then I thought to myself, this doesn't make any sense because, you know, the procedure when you have an engine overheat is to take the throttle of the overheating engine and retard it to idle to keep the engine from overheating, right? Well, both of them, we only have two engines on the airplane, both of them are indicating an overheat. And so I'm retarding both engines to idle thinking, well, I'm not going to go very far like this. And so I guess we're going to have to bail out. And then I went, wait a minute. Why are we getting all these other warnings at the same time? This is not making any sense. So the first thing that happened in the situation when I realized we were experiencing something that was not normal was the smoke. Okay, and then immediately our first reaction, boom, 100% oxygen. What does that do? Well, that prevents you from breathing any of the smoky air, the ambient air in the cockpit, right? Yes, right. That means you're not smelling the smoke anymore. But my brain made a connection. It saw the overheat warning light blinking on and off, and it knew that it was smelling smoke. So my brain made the conclusion that this was smoke from the overheating engines. In hindsight, or after I thought about it a little bit, I'm thinking, wait a minute, that may not have been engine smoke. That may have been electrical smoke. And then I looked down at our circuit breaker panel and about, I don't know, 10 to 15 circuit breakers were popped. And then I made the conclusion, oh, we have some kind of an electrical malfunction here. The engines really aren't overheating. So, you know, a quick cross check with all of the engine instruments showed that the engines were not overheating. So I thought, okay, recover, we're good. We'll start operating the engines, even though the warnings are still going off, and you still have this light that's telling me that the canopy, the glass canopy that over the top of, or plexiglass or whatever it was, over the top of us is not going to go flying off because this is a bad warning or false warning. So we recovered back to the aerodrome, the Air Force Base, and I believe, yeah, we still had radio communications all the way in. We landed on the runway straight ahead, got out of the airplane. I turned off all the, I turned off the engines. I turned off all the electrical master switches and everything else, and all of the electrical stuff was still going. Come to find out, maintenance contacted me a little while after that and said that one of the cannon plugs on the backside of the instrument panel had gotten some kind of corrosion or dirt or something in it, and it actually shorted out this cannon plug, and I think it was like 61 pins inside this big, huge cannon plug that had somehow shorted, and that's what caused all the warnings that we received that were all, you know, wrong. And they had never seen anything like that before, and I'm so, so happy that I waited that couple extra potatoes, you know, one potato, two potato, three potato, before I commanded that bailout, because if we had ejected from that airplane, number one, we would have lost a perfectly good airplane. Number two, it could have crashed and, you know, done some damage on the ground. Number three, you know, if you bail out of an airplane, there's no guarantee that you're going to have a nice, you know, floaty, you know, trip down. You may end up getting a broken bone or worse on your parachute landing fall. So a lot of bad things could have happened if I had commanded a bailout in that situation. So that was my most hair-raising experience in an airplane so far, anyway. Hopefully that'll be it. Of course, the thing that I always told my students, no matter what is happening in that airplane, when you push the microphone button, you got to sound cool and in control. And I said, as soon as you let go of the microphone button, you can start crying and screaming and and really panicking. But as soon as you press that microphone button, this is so-and-so. We got a little problem here. Have you ever noticed that? Most of the time, the pilots, when you listen to their radio communications and they're experiencing some kind of an emergency, they sound so calm, cool, and collected, because that's the most important thing. It's not how you're feeling, it's how you sound. Of course, I'm kidding. Not really. This is from Brian, Captain Jeff. A lot of Brians listen to the show. A lot of Chris's, a lot of Brian's. Only one Hillel so far. Captain Jeff, I thought you might get a kick out of the enclosed article. If you like it, maybe you could post it on your website so others can enjoy it as well. And I'm going to do that. It's going to be in the show notes. It was brought to my attention by a former coworker who was previously a sales rep for the DC-10. I know how much you liked that airplane. Okay, little correction here, Brian. I never flew the DC-10. You're probably, it's a very similar airplane made by a different company, the Lockheed L-1011. That's the one that I liked so much. Okay, the article appeared in the August 1981 issue of Playboy. I guess there really are good articles in that magazine. And then he put a little smiley face. When I was flying internationally, I would print out six or so copies and hand them out to the flight attendants. They would always come back with a smile on their face and tell me how much they enjoyed the article. Hopefully there weren't any pictures in there. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the reading or the read as much as the others. Again, I'll put the link to the bombardment method. That's the article to which he's referring that was in Playboy magazine. It was a memoir by Reg Potterton, and it is very, very well written. It's very entertaining and very hilarious, and basically it is about the late 50s in Montreal, and these were ground agents working, you know, taking people's checked baggage and ticketing them and all that kind of stuff, and how they would tend to, put the wrong baggage tag on a piece of luggage if they may have been experiencing a little problem with the passenger. And yeah, you guessed it. This bag would not arrive where the passenger was going. And in fact, it would make its way all around the world, including Bombay, or now known as Mumbai. So a very, very enjoyable read. I'm going to read it again. It's very, very clever writing. So thank you, Brian, for sending that to me. And he said, on another topic, I wrote to you a few weeks ago about the idea of starting a blog or podcast on the passenger's view of aviation. Since then, I have found myself to be part of Mitt Romney's 47%, and I'm no longer flying. I guess my 2 million mile status will have to wait until I get a new job. 8% of my division would let go due to the economy. Well, first of all, Brian, I'm sorry to hear that you lost your job, and I'll keep you in my thoughts and prayers and hope that you get a new job soon. He continues, with all of my newfound free time, I was thinking that this would be a perfect time to document my experiences. Or this was God's way of letting me know that I shouldn't do anything but look for a new job. Decisions, decisions. And then he ends by saying, until then, safe travels. Cheers, Brian. Well, thank you, Brian. Again, we'll keep you in our thoughts and prayers and hope that you get employed very soon and you're back on your way, on track for your 2 million mile status. And again, thank you for that great article.
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
And that leads us to this. Back about a week ago or so, maybe a little bit longer, a Ukrainian traveler allegedly tried to open the emergency exit door of a moving jet at Salt Lake City International Airport, later telling federal agents that he had been drunk for 50 days and had imagined a fire on the wing. Okay, let me read that again. He later told federal agents that he had been drunk for 50 days. Let's see, he was sleeping on a Delta Airlines flight, 1215 from Boston, which was landing in Salt Lake City. He was asleep. He woke up as the plane descended, and he began yelling in Russian to his seatmate that he thought the wing of the Boeing 757 was on fire. The seatmate did not understand Branovich. As the plane touched down, Branovich ran to the back emergency exit door and tried to open it, ignoring a flight attendant's orders to stop. In his efforts, Branovich caused a malfunction that jammed the door, malfunctioned the inflatable slide, and caused extensive damage to the fuselage. Not sure how that worked. The flight attendant asked the other passengers for help, and several wrestled Branovich against the opposite side of the galley. As Branovich tried to open the other emergency door, a passenger who was a former police officer put Branovich into a wrist lock and forced him to the floor. Through a translator, Branovich said he had been visiting family in Ukraine for 50 days, during which he tried to begin building a house that he had been planning. Unable to begin construction, Branovich stated that he got drunk and stayed drunk for the entire 50 days. He said, I never sobered up. He said he had had several alcoholic drinks while traveling. Now, listen to this guy's itinerary. I think I'd be drinking, too, on this. His flights took him from Kiev to Amsterdam, Amsterdam-Boston, Boston-Salt Lake City, before his planned final leg to Portland, Oregon. He could not specify how many drinks or when he drank them. He fell asleep or passed out on flight 1215. All right, so that is interesting. Needless to say. And speaking of crazy Russians, that was not my term. Somebody else put this. This is the title of his email. Dan sent me a link. And I think David McLeese also sent me a link to this same YouTube video. Dan writes, hello, Captain Jeff. Just wanted to pass along this video I watched a few minutes ago. It seems the Russians aren't convinced that clean lifting surfaces are really the way to go. Now, in defense of these guys taking off from this very, very muddy, slushy runway, I think the wings were clean. Well, sort of. I mean, the slush and the mud being kicked up by the propellers and the landing gear on the airplane probably got the wing a little bit dirty, but I don't think they were covered with ice. That's the good part. The bad part is that now you know why, if you watch this video, which will be in the show notes, now you know why that we have restrictions on taking off in certain amounts of slushy, icy runways, especially the slushy part. And so check it out. It's pretty interesting. Speaking of David McLeese, he writes, "Hey, hi, Captain Jeff. This the truck versus 717 incident this week brought to mind a similar incident years ago in or at ATL. Okay, before I continue, the 717 incident that he's talking about, I don't think I've talked about this yet on the show, was I think last week up in Milwaukee, an AirTran Boeing 717 was at the gate. They had just arrived, and they were starting the deplaning process. And one of the catering trucks went up to the right side of the airplane and rammed right into the jet. Didn't stop until it hit the airplane and did quite a bit of damage to the, what do they call that? The production splice, a joint where the forward portion of the fuselage is mated to the midsection fuselage. Apparently, what caused this little accident was a loose beverage can in the truck that somehow rolled to the floorboard and got stuck in front of the brake pedal and didn't allow the driver to apply the brakes. Of course, that's his story. And then went slamming into the Boeing 717 at Milwaukee. So that's the incident he's talking about. So that reminded him of a similar incident years ago at ATL. In 1990, an Eastern Airlines fuel truck hit an Eastern Metro Jetstream 31. The driver allegedly fell asleep during an overnight shift. And then he sent me a couple pictures from the accident. And I do recall this happening, actually. The impact actually moved the jet stream about 4 feet, bent the prop back, caved in a nice chunk of skin, and damaged the air stair door on the opposite side that was open at the time. And he said, check out the front of the truck where the springs are compressed as about as far as they can go. Typically, jet stream empty weight was around 10,000 pounds. So I would bet it was a rude awakening for the driver. Thought you would find it interesting. Yes, I did. Thank you, David. And I'm just thinking that this guy was glad that the engine wasn't running. Those propellers weren't spinning on that right engine because he ended up getting very close to that. All right. So thank you again, David, for all of your feedback. I have some voice feedback. This from Susan, I believe. Let's hear what she has to say.
Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Susan calling from Massachusetts. I just saw a very disturbing TED Talk, and I was hoping that you could comment on it. His name is Todd Humph. It was posted to iTunes in July of this year, and it's about GPS jamming and GPS spoofing devices. It's scary. GPS, especially in inclement weather, would be in big trouble if something like that happened. I was just wondering if you could comment. Thanks.
Sorry about the skips there. That was the feedback line, 304-997-4568, or 99-PILOT. So thank you, Susan, for sending that in. And yeah, we talked about it several episodes ago. A team from the University of Texas at Austin, their main campus, a team of students, along with their professor, Todd Humphreys, who did the TED Talk, apparently, went out to prove that you could actually spoof GPS signals, and they used an off-the-shelf drone to prove that that could be done. And that concerned me, too. Since then, of course, we read articles that said that I'm sorry, I'm getting distracted because I'm looking at a different piece of feedback. Let me go to the right one here. Okay. We learned that the The death of the global positioning system, GPS, may be premature as far as being concerned about spoofing GPS signals. Obviously, on the TED talk, he probably made it sound like this was something that was an immediate threat for airplanes presently using the technology. It turns out, however, that you have to have a pretty strong spoofing signal or a very weak GPS signal going into the navigational system of the drone to have any effect at all. If you're concerned about the military's use of the GPS, they use encrypted GPS signals, whereas the civilian world does not use the encrypted signals, so they're not protected per se, but basically the circuitry in the GPS is, the way I understand it, put a lot of emphasis on the signals that they're getting from above. So, you know, the satellite dishes are pointed straight up, obviously, because it's coming from a satellite in outer space. And very little reception is being received from anything that could be coming from the opposite direction from the ground. And if the signals from the ground were strong enough, they could possibly have some effect on the global positioning system of the airplane. The other thing that you have to keep in mind is that the GPS system is not being used in isolation. It's being used to complement other navigation systems on the airplane, inertial navigation systems. So you have an inertial platform, gyroscopes that are constantly analyzing and keeping track of where that platform is or where that airplane is. And the GPS signal is receiving, you know, position signals from various satellites and doing its triangulation, et cetera, to get an accurate position. So it's something that we definitely need to be concerned about, I think, but I don't think it's quite as critical as Todd made it sound. And of course, I understand where he's coming from. He is the one that headed the team of students to prove that this could be done, and I'm hoping that he's just out there warning people that we need to do something to harden our GPS systems. And I hope he's not, you know, doing this to personally, you know, make some headway in this field. I don't know. Probably not. So I have not heard the TED report myself. But thanks for sending me the voice feedback, Susan. Keep listening and keep sending feedback if you don't mind. I always appreciate it. Okay, this is the one where I thought I was pushing the button. Here, let me do this first. Okay, also received some voice feedback. This from Brian in Houston.
Hello, Captain Jeff. It's Brian from Houston, but I'm currently in the Bay Area of California. I have a question for you. I don't know if you can shed some light on this or not, but I figured you're as good as a person any to ask. I flew on an airplane over from Houston to San Francisco Airport. It was kind of dismayed when there was no entertainment system on the plane. There was no nothing on the seat back, nothing dropped down to the ceiling, zilch, and nothing. And there's some, before we took off, while we were still boarding, there's some people that were going to, that lived in San Francisco were really upset that there wasn't, direct TV on the plane, which a lot of the ones do have now, because they wanted to watch the Game 6 of the National League, series. But as they were complaining, then the flight attendants walked by, and he mentioned that didn't have any entertainment system because it was a brand new plane. And once he said that, looking around, you could tell that it was a brand new plane. I mean, everything was nice and crisp, wasn't dingy. I mean, it was new. I guess my question is, when it seems kind of odd that they would have a brand new plane and then later put in the entertainment system and not get it from the from Boeing that way, but what are your thoughts on that? If you have any, if you could shed any light on that, would appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Brian, from Houston, now in the Bay Area. And first thing I have to say is you passengers complain way too much. Whiners. No, I'm just kidding. I'd wonder about that response to your question. Why is there no entertainment system? Well, because it's a brand new airplane. That just sounds counterintuitive to me. I'm thinking, well, the new airplanes, I thought, were the ones that had all the fancy entertainment systems on them. Well, okay, I did a little research on this, and I'm assuming that you were flying from Houston to San Francisco on the airline that has a major hub in both places, United, and probably on their 737-900 series airplane. Yeah, being that you said it was a brand new airplane, and I know that they've been receiving deliveries on the 900 for a little while. And so I did a little research on it, and first thing I found was that it could have something to do with this Koito Industries, a company in Japan that makes seating for airplanes. But it turns out that this is not an issue because it only affected deliveries in the 2009-2010 timeframe. And since you were in a brand new airplane, I don't think this applied. But just to remind people about that, Koito Industries manufactures these seats for airplanes. And apparently, because they had such a huge order, heavy number of orders coming in and very, very tight scheduling, the company kind of falsified some seat tests that were required and were using tests or results from previous tests they had done and omitted parts of other tests and omitted parts of a test process to, expedite the manufacture and delivery of these seats. And, of course, when the controlling agencies found out about it, among them, the FAA, they said, I'm sorry, but you can't use these seats. So it caused a lot of delays to some aircraft deliveries, such as Al Nippon Airways' new Inspiration of Japan seats, and particularly the premium economy seats on that airline. But, and as a side, Airbus, since September of 2009, before the scandal erupted, had banned Koito from delivering seats manufactured for Airbus aircraft because of other safety violations. So as of July 2010, Boeing no longer allows airlines to fit Koito seats in new build aircraft. And that was from the Wikipedia. Now, again, a little bit more research found that apparently, and I'm not sure if this is true with Acme and other airlines, but apparently the way that United does it with Boeing is that they have it configured a certain way, and then they take the airplanes upon delivery and send them to, I believe, Orlando to have a kit installed as far as the in-flight entertainment systems are concerned. So kind of like an aftermarket install from a third-party place, I think. So apparently they're going to get all the fancy live TV and Wi-Fi and the whole bit. So, yeah, I would think that would be strange as well, especially a brand new airplane. I know it's kind of disconcerting, especially for those long segments. And that's one of the problems I have with the MD-90 that I fly, especially the long segments. Now, most of the time, the flight segments that I'm doing in the MD-88 and the MD-90 are probably somewhere in the 1 hour to 2 hour flight range. I can understand having an airplane that doesn't have an entertainment system. And, all these airplanes have Wi-Fi. So, I don't have the TV, the live TV. I don't have the movies, etc. But chances are I have an iPad or a laptop computer, and I can, or a magazine, book, whatever. I can kind of keep myself occupied. But for those flights that are going from Houston to San Francisco, or for instance, last week when I flew from Minneapolis to San Francisco and then back, that was like a 3.5 hour flight. And I think that that's kind of pushing it without having an entertainment system. And I also would be kind of torqued a little bit, especially if I were a big fan of the San Francisco Giants, because I would have looked forward to watching that playoff game myself. And so, yeah, odd. I don't know what's going on there. Again, as best I can tell, and maybe somebody out there like PJ, I think you might have some kind of connection with folks that fly at United. Maybe you can find some information about that, why the new airplanes are being delivered without entertainment systems. But that's my best guess, Brian, that they're just going to go to aftermarket installation when they get a chance. All right, let's hear some more voice feedback from who?
Hello, Captain Jeff. I don't remember what episode it was, but a few episodes ago you talked about the Italian person that was pretending to be a pilot, and you mentioned that he was copying the Leonardo DiCaprio film Catch Me If You Can. I don't know if you know or not, but the movie Catch Me If You Can was actually based on a true story of Frank Abernathy, who impersonated a pilot as well as many other things. I believe it was in the 60s. Very interesting story. There was actually a book, Catch Me If You Can, that the movie was based on, that was written by Frank Abernathy, this person that was able to impersonate a doctor, a lawyer, airline pilot, all in the name of writing hot checks. Just want to let you know that that wasn't a movie, but an actual person that the Italian guy was impersonating or copying. Have a good day.
Now, this person didn't say who it was, but it kind of sounds like Brian from Houston, don't you think? I don't know. I don't know who that was. I think it was Brian. Anyway, thank you for that clarification about Catch Me If You Can and being a book and a real-life scenario. Yeah, it was a very entertaining movie. I know that for sure. I didn't read the book. So thanks for that little piece of information, you. All right, some more voice feedback.
Hi, Jeff. It's Carl Stebbings here in the UK, across the pond, as they say, from you. Speaking to you this morning at 10 o'clock on a very windy and blustery day here in the UK. Well, we've got back from holiday now. We had a lovely holiday in Cyprus and flew out on a 767-300ER with Thomson Fly, one of the UK's sort of big package tour operators airlines. The aircraft itself, excuse me, was a nearly 15-year-old aircraft, but you wouldn't be able to tell. It was a very well maintained and a very comfortable, I think, ride. My first time on a 767. I've flown a 777, which is a fantastic aircraft to fly on long haul, but the 767 was on a par really with the 777. I think pretty much the same aircraft. But no, even though it was nearly 15 years old, it was a really good aircraft. We had a great landing, great takeoff, and we also had a lady pilot, female pilot, on the way out as well, which was quite good. So I just thought I'd drop you this line using SpeakPipe just to say hello, and thanks as always for creating a fantastic podcast like you do. And please don't worry too much about the podcast being nearly 2 hours long, because I think I speak for most of the listeners when we all say that the longer the podcast the better. I think you should try for an all-time record of a 3 hour long podcast. I think that would be pretty awesome. So Jeff, just a couple of questions for you before I go. Don't want to take up too much of your fantastic show listening to my English voice. But Jeff, just a quick question, a couple of questions for you. All the aircraft manufacturers, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, Airbus, what aircraft manufacturer would be your favourite for aircraft? Boeing, Airbus, McDonnell Douglas, Lockheed. My personal favourite, as you know, Jeff, is always going to be the Lockheed TriStar. but that's just me. But I just wondered whether you have a preferential favourite manufacturer that makes a particular type of aircraft, whether that's your favourite. And also, Jeff, I just wondered what age the aircraft you fly is. I mean, how old is the McDonnell Douglas that you fly? It's quite an old aircraft. I don't know. I just wondered if you knew how old that aircraft is and whether it is still a good old bus, as they say over here. Anyway, Jeff, thanks for listening, and hope you're all well and your family are all well. And take care and speak to you soon. And as always, clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Thanks, Jeff.
Now, Carl, you know you don't ask a lady's age, right? That's just not polite. I'll answer that question in just a moment. But first, I'll answer the first part of your question, your feedback. And that is what my favorite airplane is or was or has been. And so I got to thinking, okay, let me see, what airplanes have I flown in my flying career, so to speak? And so I wrote it down. I flew Cessnas. I've flown the 150, 152, 172, and, of course, the Air Force T-37. I've flown one airplane from Northrop, T-38 Talon, the supersonic jet trainer. Yeah, also in the Air Force, of course. Staying in the Air Force, Lockheed, the C-141 Starlifter, cargo transport, four-engine, high-wing, high-tail transport. And, the L-1011, the commercial airliner that Lockheed built, or one of them, that is. Boeing, I've only flown one Boeing. Can you believe that? The venerable three-holer, the Studebaker, the B-727. And finally, the McDonnell Douglas, MD-88 and MD-90. Now, of all of those airplanes, which one is my favorite? Well, you're not alone, Carl. My favorite is still the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar. Beautiful airplane. Now, you know, I wasn't an easy convert. I thought having flown the Boeing 727 for more than 7 years, and actually I flew it again after I flew the L-1011. I was a captain on it for nearly 2 years. So a total of approximately 8.5 years actually behind the controls of a 727 and 1.5 years on the panel. And I thought that that B-727 was hard to beat, that there's no way that any airplane could fly as beautifully as the 727. And so when I got my bid for the L-1011, I was reluctant to admit that the L-1011 TriStar was even better. And it took me about a month of flying it before I finally came around and had to admit that the L-1011, even hand-flying that airplane, was just a beautiful airplane. So that was what we called the queen of our fleet, and it's still the queen of the fleet in my mind. Boeing 727, that's a close second place. Boeing makes great airplanes. In fact, you may see the bumper sticker a lot of different places. I've seen it all over the place on flight kits and such. If it ain't Boeing, I ain't going. So a lot of strong feelings felt about the Boeing products. I hope to get to fly some more Boeing airplanes in my future. But even if I never get to fly another Boeing, I'm very, very happy and satisfied that I got to fly the 727. That 727 was amazingly solid, sturdy, stable. In fact, I may have mentioned this in the past on previous episodes where hand-flying the thing, if you got it all trimmed up, you would sometimes forget that it was not connected to the autopilot system. And I remember more than one time reaching over to the autopilot control knob and trying to bank the airplane or adjust the pitch and nothing happening with it and slightly panicking and then realizing, oh, I have not connected the autopilot system yet. That's how solid and stable that airplane was. or is. And let's see, you know, the 88, MD-88, when I was displaced off the 727, and that means that at the time at Acme, we were starting to retire the Boeing 727, which means that you're shrinking that category of pilots because, you know, the fewer airplanes you have to fly, the fewer people you need on your staff to fly it and train to fly it. And so what happens is that when they start retiring airplanes, they say, you know, we have a surplus of pilots in your position, and you should put your preferences in for the airplane that you want to fly. That is, if you have the seniority to fly it. So the only thing that I could still fly captain on at that time and still be based in Atlanta, because that's where I was living, was the McDonnell Douglas MD-88. I'd never flown it as a co-pilot. I'd never, ever planned to fly it at all. I was going to skip that airplane. Had a really bad reputation. I'm not sure why, actually, anymore. I mean, the trips were not the greatest, but they were pretty much the same type of trips that we were flying in the Boeing 727. So I flew it, and I started flying it on the line, and then I was waiting for all the bad stuff to happen, and then I realized it's really not that bad of an airplane. And I'm not going to tell people that are senior to me that could be flying it and really push me down the list, because I don't want them to, you know, switch airplanes and start flying it. So if anybody senior to me asks about the MD-88, MD-90, I tell them it's a piece of junk. Now, if you're junior to me, I will admit that the MD-88, MD-90 series of airplanes is really not that bad. It just takes time to get used to the different controls. You know, as I mentioned several times in the past, you know, the controls are basically completely manual. What we call in the 727 manual reversion. When you lose all your hydraulic systems, you are manually reverting to cables and actuating the control surfaces manually. Well, that's the way, for the most part, the MD-88 and the MD-90 works all the time. And when you finally kind of get used to that system and your brain kind of syncs up with its idiosyncrasies, not your brains, but the airplanes, it actually becomes quite a nice flying airplane. So maybe it's because I've flown it for what, 11, 12 years now? Maybe I'm just so used to it that I don't know any better. I don't know. But I do know that it won't be forever that I'll be flying this airplane. I'll move on at some point when I have the seniority on a bigger airplane that pays more money, hourly rate. And I'm going to talk about that here in just a second, because I received some feedback asking a question about that. So to summarize, I've flown not as many airplanes as a lot of people have after having flown 30 years in their aviation career. But of the ones that I have flown, my favorites are L-1011 and the 727. Okay, now, you also asked, how old is the MD-88? Well, at Acme, they entered service. Actually, we were the launch customer in 1988, January. I think the first one was delivered in December of 1987, and in January 1988, it was put into service. And the last deliveries were in about the mid-90s. So most of the 88s that we have are, I guess, let's see, that would make it around an average of 20 years old, I guess, which really isn't that old in airplane years, honestly. And let's see, the MD-90s entered commercial service in 1995, and I believe the last one rolled off the line in late 99, 2000. So they're a little bit newer, a little bit younger airplanes. They're not brand new, of course, but they're not the oldest things we have flying out there. We're still flying DC-9s. Okay, and on this, in my Evernote folder here, I have a picture that I pasted that David McLeese sent to me, and he has a picture of the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar at MCO, Orlando International Airport. In it, you can see a rainbow in the sky, a very beautiful picture behind the L-1011 at the gate. And he said he thinks he took this around 1995, 96. That was about the time that I was flying that as a co-pilot. And so, hey, who knows? Maybe I was actually flying that airplane at the time when you took that picture. Thanks for sending me that great picture and the memories associated with it, Carl. I mean, David. And Carl, again, thanks for your feedback. Great. Glad that you had a great holiday in Cyprus. Okay, now I mentioned that there was going to be one more question regarding airplanes and choices of flying them. And let me play Nick's soundbite voicemail.
Hey there, Captain Jeff. This is Nick again. Thank you so much for your reply to my last voicemail I left you about flight school and how you got to where you were or you are right now. A lot of information there. Great explanation. Didn't expect to get as much of an answer as I did, which is fantastic. So thank you very much for that. Just have another question for you as far as your career goes. And that would be, I know that you currently fly the MD-80s, MD-90s, and I was wondering if, since you've been with ACME for quite a few years now, if that is a personal choice as far as the aircraft that you're currently flying, or if that's the only one that they allow you to fly. I know you have certain ratings and stuff like that, and throughout the career you can move up as far as bigger aircraft and everything goes, but wasn't sure if maybe that was just a preference of yours, or if you've had other offers to fly the bigger jets, or how that goes. So that'd be good to know. So I look forward to hearing your next podcast, and thank you very much for your time. Have a good day.
Well, thanks, Nick, for your voice feedback. And flying the MD-88 for the most part is a personal choice. And the way it works in our system, and this is true, I think, for most airlines around the world. Now, there are exceptions. There are some airlines that your pay is based on your years of service and whether or not you're, or and what your position is, whether you're a first officer or a captain. Our system at ACME, and as I said, at many of the major airlines, is based on longevity or years of service and your position on the particular airplane that you're flying, but also each of those airplanes in your fleet has a base rate, a base hourly rate. Did you know that we're hourly wage earners? And again, for most airline jobs around the world, we're not salaried workers. We actually get paid an hourly wage. Now, our hourly wage, and this is something that happens when we're in negotiations and people say, look at how much money these pilots are making. They make, you know, $150 an hour. Well, that's because people are comparing it with a typical 40-hour work week, where our month is usually somewhere around 70 to 80 hours. Okay, not a a full month's work for a normal hourly wage earner would be, what, 40 times 4, so about 160 hours or so. So you can see that it's comparing apples and oranges to look at an airline pilot's hourly pay rate, and then you look at a lawyer's or a doctor's hourly rate. That's just not compare. You can't compare compare it as apples and oranges. So that said, we have pay scales based on the particular airplane. I use particular too much. I'll have to stop doing that. And the smallest airplane, as far as seating capacity and range and gross weight and some other weird factors involved in how they come up with these pay rates, is going to get the lowest rate per hour for the captain. And in general, the first officer will make about two-thirds of that rate, 67%, roughly 70%, somewhere in there. So let's just use airplane A. It's the smallest airplane. It gets the captain gets $100 per hour. Remember, our hours are based on when we block out from the gate until the time that we block into the gate. So this trip that I'm flying right now is a three-day trip, and it's worth, I don't know, around 15 hours, 15 and a half hours, something like that. So I'm actually gone from home, you know, three full days. So obviously more than 15 hours away from home, obviously more than 15 hours that I'm actually working. All the pre-flight planning and pre-flight inspections, sitting around between flights, etc., I'm not getting paid for. It's only blocking out to blocking in. So again, that's a little bit different when you're comparing pay rates with other hourly wage earners. But let's just say that the smallest airplane that we have in our fleet, the captain makes $100 per hour and the first officer makes $70 an hour. If you want to fly the next biggest airplane or the next higher pay rate, you have to have the seniority to fly it. And so we have a process called advanced entitlements. And they periodically through the year, when things are really moving rapidly, you might have several advanced entitlements during the year. Or when things are very stagnated, you may not have one for a couple years. And what happens is the airline looks at the fleet. It looks at the manning of the fleet and whether or not they have enough pilots in each position at each base for that particular airplane, or they have too many. So you either have vacancies or surpluses. And so we look at the choices we have as far as, you know, our seniority can hold. Let's say right now, I'll just use me for an example. My seniority, if there were an advanced entitlement and a position was available on that airplane, I could fly everything that we have at ACME except the 747, the 777, and I'm not sure. I'd be very, very close to the Airbus 330. Those are all wide body. And the 767-400 as well. I think that's also the group where I'd be either at the very, very bottom, and I mean like the last one on the seniority list, or maybe I don't have the seniority now. It varies. Every month, your position on an airplane based on your seniority will change. And so let's just say now that the biggest thing that I can fly, and I know for sure that I could do it, is the 767 ER, or the international category for the 767. And that's in Atlanta. Now, if I wanted to fly the 767-400, which is a higher pay rate, a little bit bigger airplane, I could fly it out of New York and hold that. But I don't want to commute from where I live in Atlanta to New York just so that I can fly a bigger airplane and make a little bit higher hourly pay rate. So I look at where I would be, my position on the 767ER in Atlanta, and I'd say, I'd only be 15% from the bottom of the list. That means that I'd be on reserve. In other words, I wouldn't have a real schedule. I'd just be on call certain days of the month. I'd never really know when I'd be gone and when I'd be home. Never really know where I'd be in the world. Probably fly the kind of cruddy trips on that airplane. The 767 domestic category, I'd be about 75% from the top or 25% from the bottom. Again, not a good place to be. I would not have very much control over my schedule. And I would be flying pretty cruddy, crappy trips. So you can see that those are some of the things that we look at when we are deciding what we are going to put our bid in for as far as where we're going to be based and the airplane that we're going to fly. Again, I've probably said this many times, but you know, in real estate, the three most important things is location, location, and location, right? In the airline industry, for the most part, the three most important things are seniority, seniority, and seniority. And seniority not only means the airplane that you're flying and how much money you could possibly make, it means where you're based, it means when you take your vacations, it means having your weekends off or not, it means flying to Africa or not, it means several different things. So everything is based on your seniority. So for now, for me, another thing to add into this whole mix is that since our airline went into bankruptcy and it has emerged from bankruptcy, the pay scales have been very compressed. And what I mean by that is that the differences between airplanes, as far as the hourly rates are concerned, are not huge. They used to be really, really big jumps. So you may say, you know what, I can hold that next bigger airplane now, and yeah, I'm going to suffer a little bit with my juniority or lack of seniority, but it's going to be worth it because I'm going to be making so much more money. So it's worth, the pain is kind of compensated by the higher pay rate. Now, the pay rates are so similar I mean, it is an increase as you fly bigger airplanes, but it's not a significant jump anymore. And so now you have to really take that into account. And for me, especially at my age, I'm in, you know, I'm 53, almost 54 years old, staying in the same time zone or maybe just a couple of time zones away from my home time zone, keeping my circadian rhythm relatively stable, flying short trips, not having to be away from home a long time, getting to pick the trips that I want to fly during the week, having the weekends off if I want, being off for Christmas, being off for holidays and birthdays and all that kind of stuff. Hey, that's important to me. And so I'm really enjoying my seniority. And until I have that kind of seniority on the next bigger airplane, well, I'm staying put. So that's a little bit more than you probably wanted to know, Nick, about why I fly the MD-88. And you know what? It's not that bad of an airplane. Don't tell any of my senior friends. Okay, let me look through the list here and make sure I have everything that I wanted to talk about. Oh, you know, one last thing. I had this toward the top of my list and I somehow skipped it. This is from one of the Brians, Brian Flynn. He writes, hi, Captain Jeff. Have been listening to your podcast for a few months now. And he said, I think I can guess the airline you fly for. And, of course, I wrote back to him and said, yep, you guessed it right. Last week was his first time flying this air, or my first time flying this airline. And imagine my excitement when I learned my return flight would be on an MD-90. It was the first time I'd flown on this type of aircraft. And there was even a slight chance he'd be my pilot. Although one of the other passengers remarked that the captain had a very relaxing voice. There is no way you could have been flying to Denver that same night you were in Oklahoma City. Yep, you're right. This brings me to my question. Have you ever had a listener recognize you at work? I've only heard the names of the captain and first officer announced on a flight once when flying with another airline. Any thought on this practice? Well, as far as I know, at least nobody has told me that they've recognized my voice. I have seen people that I know on a flight, like getting off the airplane and saying goodbye, and I'm going, whoa, I kind of recognize that person. Oh, wait, he just lives down the street from me, you know, that kind of thing. But I haven't had any of my airline pilot guide listeners come up to me after a flight and say, hey, Captain Jeff, I recognized your voice. So as far as I know, I don't think anybody has flown on any of my flights. But I'm sure it's going to happen one of these days. It's a small world. And I wrote back to Brian saying that, you know, I don't usually announce my name or my first officer's name. Sometimes it just sounds pretentious, I guess. Perhaps I should pose this question to the listeners. What's your take? And he wrote back, my theory is part of the reason the public has a negative perception of flying in airlines is that so often the flight crew appears as nameless, soulless drones. There is little smiling or talk whatsoever unless a passenger needs something. Perhaps I'm nostalgic for the days when airlines try to make flying fun, even though I'm not old enough to remember those days. Thanks. That's a little rib. But getting back to the name thing, I think it would add a personal touch, Brian. So, Brian, thank you for your take on that issue. And to my listeners out there, what do you think? Do you think I should announce my name when I'm doing my announcement? By the way, this trip, I started to do that. I think I used to do that. But then after a while, I thought, nobody cares what my name is. They just need to know that I'm the captain, right? So, and I'm one of those captains, one of those pilots that you hear a lot about. I always try to put myself in your shoes as a passenger. When we're sitting there at the gate and we're supposed to push back at 5 after and it's 10 after and we're still sitting at the gate, now it's 15 minutes past. And I haven't heard a thing from the pilots, that irritates me as a passenger. When we're holding out for a gate and we're just sitting on the ramp and the airplane's not moving and I'm thinking about my connection and I don't hear anything, that irks me when I'm flying as a passenger. And so I try to, again, put myself virtually in your position, in your place, and try to think about what you're thinking. And so when we're, and this has happened already several times on this trip, we're sitting at the gate. We've put in our request for pushback. We're all ready to go, but there are airplanes behind us preventing us to push back from the gate. You're sitting there going, we're not moving. What's going on? Is there something wrong with the airplane? And that's when I come on and say, hey, this is your captain. I just wanted to let you know that we are all ready to go up here. We have our request for pushback, but we have to wait because there are airplanes behind us right now, and once they're out of the way, we'll be pushing back for our flight to blah, blah, blah. Again, today, coming into the ramp in Atlanta, at the very, very last minute, these guys ahead of us took our gate, and they were told to, by the way. And we said, hey, we're coming into the ramp right now, and we're supposed to be going to T5, and they just took our gate. Where are we going? And they said, well, hang on. So we had to sit on the ramp for a little bit, and now we're getting very, very close to our scheduled arrival time. And so immediately I thought, I need to say something. So I got on and said, hey, look, the flight ahead of us went into our gate. We're not sure why. We're trying to find out. They're trying to coordinate another gate for us. If you're looking over there on the left at the gate right next to the one we're supposed to be in, it's empty, but they tell us that it's not set up for our airplane. And then the one right next to that one has an airplane in it. It's the same type of airplane as ours, and they're going to be pushing back probably in the next 5 to 10 minutes. And so for now, that's what they're planning on doing with us, you know, taking that gate once that gate is vacant. And then, of course, it worked out that they found another gate that was already open on a different ramp, so we just had to make the transition to a ramp. But you get the idea. I'm always on the PA trying to communicate, and I've said this so many times, and you're probably getting tired of me hearing about it. Communication is so important, and that's why I like to communicate a lot. And so I will, for now, unless somebody tells me I don't care what your name is, I'll start using my name. So should I use Captain Jeff, or should I say Captain Nielsen, or Captain Jeff Nielsen? What do you think? Let me know. Okay, I think that is it. Let me take a look here. We got Halal, and we got the Anchorage feedback. We got all those videos. We got the crazy Russians. We got the all that. Yes, yes, yes. All right. I think I've cleared out the feedback queue, and it's time to end the show. So let me go to the closing script here. Yeah, you know it. You too can send feedback, because really, this show is more than 50% based on your participation, your feedback, because I answer the questions that you have about my career field, especially the job as a pilot behind that cockpit door. But if you ask me a question that I'm not sure about the answer, for instance, the way marketing chooses certain size airplanes for certain market segments, then I appeal to people out there who may know the answer, Jan. And I'll get back to you when I find that information out. So send me some feedback. Feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Call my voice feedback number, which is 304-99-PILOT, 304-997-4568. Or, hey, it's even easier. Just go to airlinepilotguy.com and click on the Send Voicemail tab on the right. Can't miss it. On Facebook, I'm Captain Jeff. Just do a search for that. And I also have a page, Airline Pilot Guy. On Twitter, I'm the Airline Pilot Guy, or just Airline Pilot Guy, not the. Or Jeff Nielsen, that's my personal one. And Stitcher Radio. You can now hear Airline Pilot Guy while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. My latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, and no memory or storage wasted. It's available for your iPhone, your iPad, Android phones, and beyond. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com, that's Stitcher.com/airlinepilot, and that will give you a link that gives me a little bit of credit, I guess. I'm not sure exactly what it does. You can download the Stitcher.com app. Remember, Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Oh, and the other thing I meant to mention, and I thought I had it written down in one of my feedback narratives, but apparently I just skipped right over it. Somebody had mentioned wanting to donate to this Airline Pilot Guy cause. I still haven't come up with any t-shirts or coffee mugs or anything like that. It's still kind of swimming around in my little brain. But in the meantime, if you want to buy me a cup of coffee, that's what I put on my little button. If you want to go to the website Airline Pilot Guy, or if you're one of those who is subscribed to my Catholic Pilot feed, either one, you can find the little button that says, Buy Captain Jeff a Cup of Coffee. You click on that button, it takes you to a PayPal donate page, Don't get put off by the fact that it says Nielsen Design Studio, my now defunct business doing t-shirt and other printing. And you can give me a little donation if you'd like. I'm not saying you have to do that. Obviously, this is a labor of love. I am definitely not doing it for the money. I'm not making any money at all on this yet. So if you want to give me a donation, please feel free. I don't want that money to burn a hole in your pocket, darn it. And so until we meet again, remember, the quality of the box matters little. Success depends upon the man who sits in it. Now, who do you think that quote comes from? A German named Manfred von Richthofen. Richthofen. Probably mispronouncing that name. But we all know him as the Red Baron. Yes, again, the Red Baron and his quote. The quality of the box matters little. Success depends upon the man who sits in it. Wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.